The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Art museums can be intimidating. First, for children, who might rather be over at the Egypt wing looking at mummies, and then later for adults. But why? We readily talk about movies, music, sports, and politics, but when was the last time you got into a passionate conversation about a painting or a sculpture? Tamar Avishai is a former art historian and host of the Lonely Palette podcast, which focuses on one work of art across the historic spectrum per episode. The Lonely Palette landed on a few notable year-end playlists for 2016, including Wired. Tamar Avishai sat down with Virginia Prescott to talk about her goal of making art a little less scary.
Tamar Avishai, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So nice to have you here. First, a little on you. Can we call you a recovering art historian?
Yeah, that's something I've been trying to call myself. For a while, it was erstwhile art historian. But I still am. You know, by actually making the podcast, I'm realizing that I am an art historian. And it's nice to get back into it because it was a rocky relationship for a while.
Oh, good. Well, so we're not going to say anything bad about art historians. But I do wonder, you know, you describe your podcast as returning art history to the masses. Did art ever belong to the masses?
That's a good question. That's a good way of getting into it. Museums never really belonged to the masses until pretty recently. Artists and art historians have always had a bit of a frustrating relationship because the artists are the ones who are doing the work that is so subjective and really speaking to the context that they're coming from, especially modern art, which is what I'm really interested in. And art historians, their role is to take these stories and make them a little bit more universal, but also putting them kind of in a box that then is how it is taught and how it is presented, how it's displayed. The artists say, well, this is really personal and really subjective to me. And then you have art historians looking back and saying, yeah, but look at where you're coming from and look at where this art, what it leads to. And artists don't really want to be treated like that. But it's true. Both are true.
Why do you think people are afraid to talk about art?
Because they're really scared of being wrong. They're really scared of sounding stupid. I can't tell you how many times I've pointed a mic in somebody's face at a museum and asked them not to say anything about art history and just describe what they see, and nobody thinks that they're allowed to. No one thinks that if they don't have a background in art history, that they're allowed to actually speak about it intelligently.
Well, one of the things you do in the podcast is you put that on tape, people describing what they see. Here's a little edited bit of what people thought looking at a painting a number of people may have seen at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. John Singer Sargent's The Daughters of Edward Darley Boyt.
These four girls in this mostly dark interior, but they're illuminated by this, I don't know if the best word is delicious or juicy, morning light coming through.
It's almost like the four girls are acting their age. The two younger ones are like interested and the older ones are kind of more like not interested.
The Daughters of Edward Darley Boyt, if you haven't seen it, is a huge painting that's pretty dark. And you have these four girls. They go by age. So the youngest is little 4-year-old who's sitting on the floor in front. And then a little bit further back is an 8-year-old. And then in the back are two adolescents, one who's kind of looking out and one who isn't even acknowledging you at all, who's leaning against this huge, huge Chinese vase. And it is meant to be a portrait of these girls, but it's very awkward for a portrait. To have a portrait where you don't even see a girl's face because she's turned away from you goes against everything that portraiture should be, and yet you learn so much more about who she is because she's not looking at you.
Well, Well, I loved hearing some of the responses that you got from people, like the juicy light, you know, it's just lovely. And people are connecting with it and looking at it in a strong way. But these are people at a museum looking at a painting. It's much more challenging, I know, on the radio, mm-hmm. on a podcast, describing something. So how do you make it come alive, make it exciting?
There are two issues here. One is that trying to put the visual on radio is its own challenge. People are used to, though, using audio guides. And so that's something that I can work off of, that standing in front of a painting and listening to a podcast or a piece of audio is something that people are actually really familiar with. But getting them to talk and the way that they describe the painting is actually really fun. It took a little while to kind of perfect my pitch, because you have to both make them feel comfortable talking about art at all and then also kind of get good tape out of them. Because what I want from them is pure description. I don't want them to really analyze or interpret the object at all. I just want them to describe what they see. Hmm. Because if you are then listening, that's all you need to hear first and foremost is in your mind's eye, what are you looking at?
That was one of the funniest comments that I saw about your podcast from the radio host from Boston, Christopher Lydon. He said, this is what those snooze-a-thon museum audio tours should sound like.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear. This is a little clip from the episode from The Lonely Palette on Edward Hopper's room in Brooklyn.
Hopper plays with the qualities of stillness the way that Monet plays with the qualities of light. You never knew how many ways there were to be quiet, or expectant, or deep, until you walk up to a Hopper with footsteps that suddenly feel too loud and drop into it like a stone with no thump.
My guest is Tamar Avishai. She's an art historian turned podcaster and host of The Lonely Palette, which aims to make art history cool, one painting at a time. So that's a beautiful description. That's inviting to me. And that, I think it's that art historian language that sometimes throws me off or people off, you know, when they're talking about context. And even when you say modern art or a modernist, not everybody knows what that means. How would you define it?
I would define a modernist as actually more of a cultural historian than an art historian. And that's what I really loved about it. And that's why I got a little bit booted out of the art historian fold. And so I feel like what about modern art is so interesting. And modern art, it's modern art with a capital M. So that's, you know, kind of 1850 to 1950. You know, you've got what's going on in Europe is just fascinating. And you get into the 20th century and you have two world wars and you have the artists who are really learning how to kind of honor the first person perspective and what it means to really look at things and what it means to internalize a really complicated world through your very specific and subjective interpretation and your eyes. And you have all of these artists who are basically doing just that in a lot of really different, interesting ways. And so it can always come back to how an artist is experiencing the world. And I just find that time in history really interesting.
Well, it's a fascinating thing that comes up in your episode on Christian Boltanski's Lumière's Blue Square, Sylvie. First, if you could just briefly describe it.
It's an artwork that's very easy to walk by, even though it's really beautiful. It's rows and rows of light bulbs, but they're very dim and they have a little kind of bluish hue to them. And in the center, they're gridded really beautifully. And then in the center, you have a very grainy and kind of amorphous photo of a little girl that looks like it's a photo, but it's been like a photo that's been photographed over and over again so that it loses its integrity.
So it's funny when you're talking with people about it. I mean, this is one of those things that people think, oh, she looks like she must have been a Jewish refugee. It's of that period of time. Not really sure what the light bulbs are about. And that's one of those things that we have this lack of agency in considering art. You know, like if it's difficult to figure out, it must be really important. But in this case, we assume that this is somebody, Sylvie, that he knew and loved and was disappeared like so many people in his own family during the war, he being Jewish. But we learn that our projections are totally off. Here you are from the Lonely Palette.
He's interested in how memory objectively works, and more importantly, how it fails us. Because the truth is, this is a photo he found at a flea market. We have no idea who she is. He has no idea who she is. And the entire narrative that we created around her, her life as a 1930s French schoolgirl cut short by Auschwitz, is completely projected onto her by us.
Tamar, what does that reveal to you?
That we are invited to participate in art a lot more than we think we are.
Well, I do see that with a Hopper painting or John Singer Sargent. You know, these are both portraits. They're both recognizable. They're accessible. Mm-hmm. But the experience that a lot of people have of art, especially contemporary art or installations in galleries, is not accessibility. In fact, deliberate inaccessibility. Like, we have to know the story in that case. Mm-hmm. How would you encourage somebody to view that differently?
I mean, first things first, see what the curator has said about it. So there's always wall text next to an object. As long as you understand that the story that the curator is telling is still a story of theirs, and that they are interpreting it for you, and then also hopefully giving you some room to interpret it yourself, then that's always a really good point of entry, and that's always a nice way of kind of starting that experience with the object. But then, you know, see if there's anything when you look at it that speaks to you. See if you see something the longer you stare at it. I opened an episode on Mondrian with a quote that my mom used to love to say, that an art teacher of hers told her, that to really appreciate abstraction, you need a chair. That to really understand a Mondrian or a Pollock or a Rothko, you just have to sit with it for a while and really give yourself over to it. And every object in a contemporary gallery benefits from time with it and really kind of letting yourself approach it from every direction and try and understand why the artist wanted you to see this.
Or 15 minutes at a time in the case of Lonely Palette.
Yeah, or just listen to the podcast.
That was Tamar Abishai, host of the Lonely Palette podcast, speaking with Virginia Prescott. Singing in front of millions is a dream for lots of kids. It was for Alex Preston from Mount Vernon, New Hampshire. And here he is, one of the top five contenders from the 13th season of American Idol.
Say something, I'm giving up on you. And I'll be the one if you want me to. Cause anywhere I would follow you. Say something, I'm giving up on you.
Alex Preston there from the 13th season of American Idol. Virginia had a chance to sit down with Alex a few days ago. I'll let her take it from here.
Alex made it to the top three, where he played one of his own songs in the final and came away a second runner-up. After a self-titled debut album, he is back in the area touring. He was at the Stone Church in Newmarket, the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, and the Opera House in Gorham over the weekend. So you missed him, but we're pretty sure he's going to come back. Aren't you, Alex?
Yeah, definitely.
You make your way. Is your family still here?
Yeah, I'm staying with them right now.
Well, great. That was a pretty bold move, though, wasn't it, playing one of your own songs in the final?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was excited about it because we got to record it, so that's kind of the highlight of that week for me. But it was definitely an experience and pretty nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, people would go for the crowd pleaser, I would think, if they're trying to appeal.
Yeah, it's all about playing the hits. Like,
so why'd you do it? It's a big risk.
They actually, I had always asked if I could do an original song, like full production, and a lot of the other people wanted to as well, so they had a week where we played our audition songs with the full band. So incidentally, I got to play an original, which is cool.
So the song is Fairy Tales.
Yeah, yes.
You know, I couldn't help but notice you brought your guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you want to maybe play a little of that for us today?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is Alex Preston playing the song Fairy Tales.
The kid drum starts playing and it matches my beating heart. Nowhere to go, no one to see. Is it the finish line or the start? So I look into your soft green fields. Oh, and I see only sunlight and trees. And it makes me wonder, oh Lord, it makes me wonder, can you even see me? Yeah, so take my hand. Jump over this mess. This is a fairy tale. Oh, you're the damn soul in distress. Cross the river to the other side. Oh, I promise you that it's nicer here. Take your hands from your face, don't hide. Cause there is no reason for your fear, no reason for your fear.
Alex Preston singing his original composition, Fairy Tales, that he also sang on the 13th season of American Idol. Has it been difficult for you to, I don't know, transition away from that sort of American Idol framework where you've got all these people kind of serving you, grooming you into the regular old music biz?
Yeah, it's definitely pretty intense. When I got on Idol, I was pretty much just starting my career anyways. Like, I was really new to it, and then everything just happened at once, you know?
Was that a dream that you'd had all the time to be on American Idol?
No, I used to watch it when I was younger, but my dad told me that they are auditioning, and I actually missed the audition, so I just uploaded a video to, like, their website.
Wow, and you made it on the strength of that alone?
Yeah.
And what kind of music had you been doing before that? I think I read something about you wrote your first song at 12.
Yeah, all throughout high school, or middle school and high school, I was in, like, bands that would kind of play at, like, school and stuff. So I'd always been writing, but I never really did the whole solo thing.
Well, now you're living in Nashville, which is, I guess, a little different than Mount Vernon.
Yeah, it's a nice medium between New Hampshire and LA. Like, there's some entertainment there, but it's also, you drive 10 minutes outside, and it's like farms.
Is it?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Are you going country? I mean, this is a place where country music's made.
Yeah, I'm definitely not going country, but I feel like country music is pretty inspiring in this, like, for songwriting purposes. Because everyone down there is so passionate about writing that they pretty much do it 9 to 5. And I've never thought about songwriting that way. I've always just kind of, like, had an idea, like, every, maybe, like, once a month even, like, something will come up. But I've never, like, done it as a job. So I felt like it would be good practice getting myself out of that shell.
Well, we're going to play a little from Get Up, Get Down. This has definitely got some blues glowing through it and a little twang.
Hang on just a little bit longer, caught on at the end of the day. Realize that you're gonna keep singing, what you're gonna get is what you're gonna pay. So, and I know that you're gonna get crazy, and I know that it's gonna get strange. A count to three, come with me, cause lately a spirit can grow but a soul won't change. So get up and come far away, so get down with every word you say. And I'm going strong, yeah. So get up and go far away. So get down with every word you say. And I'm going strong. I'm going to do 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 it do 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 do. When you wanna preach, you gotta open your mouth, put your air through your pores and let the words flow out.
So Alex, coming up third or second in American Idol, I've heard maybe kind of a blessing in disguise. I mean, you don't have to make the album they write, you don't have to sort of follow their track. Do you think there's some creative freedom in that?
There's definitely creative freedom, because I did the last album out in the desert, you know, like with just...
Which
like,
desert?
Sierra Nevada, right at the base of Mount Whitney. We rented out a rock climbing cabin for a month and just like did it. And, you know, you couldn't do that on the label, but the label has such great like marketing budget and stuff. So being an independent artist is definitely hard, but it's fun and it's, you know... You get more freedom for sure.
I'm wondering about that desert thing. Did you have to be far away from it all? Is that was the goal?
I wanted one of my favorite artists, Justin Vernon. He's from Bon Iver. He went out to a cabin in Wisconsin, and I liked that idea. And so I went to the Alabama Hills in California, and just didn't know anybody. And it was pretty random, but it was definitely inspiring.
I wonder if that's a little New Hampshire like.
Yeah, definitely.
The little house in the big woods.
Yeah.
Well, how do you think growing up in New Hampshire, being here, shaped your sound?
I'm pretty introverted, and I don't know. I feel like growing up in New Hampshire, there wasn't much to do other than kind of play, like be by yourself a lot and play music. And I don't know. I'm from Mount Vernon, so the closest grocery store is like 20 minutes. So, yeah, it's definitely helped me become a little bit more self-aware.
For you, Alex, you know, you said you were an introvert. You were sort of thrust into the national spotlight.
Yeah.
What did that do to you, so, you know, psychically, emotionally? I'm sure thrilling, but
yeah.
Are there downsides?
It was pretty intense for an introvert because they had, like, stage coaches that would make you, like, stare down the camera. And whenever we had to go to, like, these classes where we would practice our stage presence. And I always had to, like, stay after class because I couldn't do it. I was just bad at it. And but it definitely pushed me out of my shell a little bit. I mean, I'm still an introvert, but it helped a lot.
What do you think is going to be next for you? You've got one record out.
Yeah. I'm definitely doing another album. I'm booking the studio right now. So
out in the desert?
No, we're doing it in Nashville. Actually, another American Idol alum from a few years before me, he's producing it, so it'll be cool. I'm excited to see how it differs from the first one, you know, with a totally different production style.
Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
And playing some music. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, anytime.
That was Virginia Prescott speaking with singer-songwriter Alex Preston. And here's one more song, which Alex played in the studio for us. This one is called My Best Friend.
We are all the same. We feel the same pains. Domesticated creatures with different last names. No matter what I was in life, no matter what I did, I could look into your eyes and see myself as a kid. And grassy fields, salty bay. Sting my eyes again.
My Best Friend, played live at the NHPR studio by Alex Preston.
It's not the end. Thank you for protecting me as pretty as a flower. I wish I just had one more day or even one more hour.
with my best friend.
And it's time for another episode of the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. This week, Virginia Prescott gets some literary advice from Otessa Moshfegh, a regular contributor to the Paris Review and author of the novel Eileen.
Hi, it's Otessa Moshfegh, and this is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
Otessa Moshfegh says she writes to explore why people do weird things. The daughter of a Croatian mother and an Iranian father, she was a serious piano student who knew she didn't want to be a pianist when she felt the call to write. And not just write, but be bold and be published. She didn't want to wait 30 years to be discovered. So she bought a copy of Alan Watts' book, The 90-Day Novel, which led her to publish Eileen, a novel of genre fiction that was hailed as noir and ended up shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. It was a big F off to the industry. I was pretty hostile, she told The Guardian on the day the nomination was announced. I thought, fine, I'll play this game, and I still feel like I'm playing it. That was in 2015. Otessa Moshfegh is now out with a collection of stories called Homesick for Another World, and seems to be enjoying the game, if that's what it still is. We spoke to her before her reading at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and asked which is harder for her when writing, starting or finishing?
The middle is the hardest. I usually get to the middle of a nervous breakdown, think I have gone the wrong direction, and sometimes do go in the wrong direction. And then at some point I know what the ending is, and then it's a process of figuring out how to get from the middle to the end. And that's always the hardest part.
How do you know when you're done? How do you know that ending?
People have been asking me that so much. How do you know when something is done? It's just a psychic vision, vibration. I know how I started. This is where I want to leave the reader. Sometimes it can be really impractical. Like, how am I going to get from here to there? But I'll know that's where I need to leave it. And then it's kind of a puzzle you need to put together in some ways.
How much plotting or planning do you do before you write? And how much does that veer off?
So for the collection of short stories that just came out, I plotted almost none of them. They start with a voice. The voice tells me where it wants to go, tells me what the story is, what the character needs or wants or fears or is running away from. And at a certain point, the story just starts to write itself. It's very rare that the plot of a story will come to me full form before I've sat down to write it. Although that does happen, it's usually when I've stolen stories from people.
What do you mean, stolen stories?
Oh, like stories that somebody's told me. And usually, you asked about veering off. Usually, I end up veering off. I'm like, oh, no, I think I can make this more interesting than what really happened or what the person told me what really happened. So there's a lot of fictionalizing, even in truth-telling.
So do you write on a schedule? Do you think I have to get up at this time and I write until that time? Does that work for you or how do you do it?
I tend to wake up early and generate the most work, like maybe like before lunch. And I think partly it's because I'm still kind of in the dream world. There isn't a lot of me interrupting myself, or it's like I can sort of just keep writing. And then in the afternoon, it's much more fits and starts and getting up and going to do the dishes and going out and coming back and looking at it and walking away. But I also like think a lot of work happens when I'm not looking at the work. I do a lot of Googling while I'm writing, but research, what does that flower actually look like? Is that indigenous to this part of the world that I'm writing in? And then I'll just get on some kind of crazy train, and usually it's helpful because it will be a path to something that I could have never thought of before will remind me of something that I wanted the character to say or do. And so,
what do you think is the biggest mistake or way that a new writer gets off track?
Well, I think people can get off track very early on by caring too much what other people are writing. And I would say if I was going to give any advice to anybody who wanted to be a writer, I would say get off social media instantly and stop asking your friends for validation. Don't read what you don't like. and don't write when you're bored.
Is that advice that you took when you were starting out?
No, I think it's just what's worked for me. And every time that I've gotten distracted or sidetracked or depressed about being a writer, it's because I've forgotten why I'm writing. It has nothing to do with what's popular or who's going to like me. You have to protect it, even though it sounds insane. You know, like, I must be writing these sentences today. Like, no, I can't go out with you. No, I cannot, you know, like your post. I have something really important to do, and it is, like, to figure out how I'm going to get from A to B in this story that I'll probably, you know, delete half of the next day. And so, like, what kind of insane person would dedicate their life to doing something like that? Well, you really need to be insane and dedicated. But I think privacy and, like, self-protection from the garbage all around us is really important to a writer, especially starting out when you don't have those natural filters. You need thick armor.
What's the best advice that you ever got about being a writer?
I think one thing that really changed the way that I looked at my writing was when somebody that I liked told me that clarity was important. I mean, this sounds so trivial, but I had never actually thought about it before. I mean, I was probably 19 when I heard this concept of writing clearly. And I think up until then, I had really seen writing as an aesthetic art form. I hadn't even thought about narrative. I was more of a prose poet, and I felt like writing was a rebellion from having to say something. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I didn't want to be in conversation with anything. So I was writing against meaning, and the experience of reading my work, I hoped, was just to, like, challenge the imagination. And when this idea of clarity came in, I was like, oh, what if I took that on as a responsibility? Suddenly my work really changed. I started looking at my sentences differently. And a writer named Gary Lutz, who was really influential when I was, like, a late teen, and I think is just one of the weirdest people and writers, totally fascinating. His work and the precision of his grammar, again, this sounds so trivial, but he is so masterful. He understands the English language on such a level, and people misuse our language so much, and writing can feel really sloppy a lot of the time. So taking like a magnifying glass to my sentences and really looking at them close up for clarity was really helpful.
How about the worst advice?
The worst advice was probably to write what I know. That's just stupid.
Do you have a desert island book?
Probably be a blank book. Blank notebook.
Do you have a fantasy job other than writer?
If I could do anything, I'd be a singer. I just wasn't born to be a singer. I think that must just be the most incredible feeling, like to sing gospel or something like that. But if I was going to be brainy, I'd really love to study birds and flowers and insects and the natural world.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
That was the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop with Otessa Moshfegh. Her new short story collection is called Homesick for Another World. Thanks for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Ari De Niro, Blue Dot Sessions, and Franco Luzzi. There's loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. You can listen on your own schedule with the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play. I'm Taylor Quimby in Fort Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.